Talk Cheese.
Recorded live.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Pastor Eli James here, and we're doing our continuing series on the Old Testament here on the Christogenos Show. My guest, as usual, is William Fink, and we're going to start on the book of Jeremiah. I just have, as usual, I'm going to be reading from my scholarly version of the King James, which has every preface and introduction for every chapter, and it's typical Judeo garbage that, you know, their commentary, but it's instructive to understand where these people are coming from and how they distort the Word of God so that it becomes universalized, right? And so it's instructive to read their comments to show how they're distorting the Word. But I want to start tonight with, I've been cleaning up my shelves and sorting out papers and old emails and old articles that, you know, I do that from time to time when I have time available for that purpose, just to straighten my, you know, files out. And I came across a letter from Arnold Kennedy. And Arnold was the guy that I was relying on to help me dissect false Greek, right, before Bill came along. And so he and I had gone back and forth many times, although he was usually agreeable to, even though he was not a two-seed liner, he was usually agreeable to everything that was separatist. He was definitely a separatist, no doubt about it, okay? And I sent him an article by Harold. I forget his first name, but Harold the... He's the preterist who has the Anointed Standard Version. You've seen that, haven't you, Bill? The Anointed Standard Version.
Yeah, he's a clown.
Yeah, he's a preterist.
Yeah, an Anointed Standard New Testament. Yeah.
Right. And I have.
He really perverts. He really corrupts some of that Greek language support his preterism.
What he mainly does, though, is he retranslates it to restore the racial language of the original Greek. And I noticed that you didn't do anything like that or nearly as much as that as Harold did in his
Well, because I don't read into the Greek ideas that aren't really there.
Right. So I quoted a passage here. This is 1 Corinthians 3:16-17 from the Anointed Standard Version, and I sent it to Arnold Kennedy. And so I'm going to quote the Anointed Standard Version here. Do you not know that you are a house of God and the mentality of God dwells in you? If anyone mongrelizes the house of God, God will mongrelize that one, for the house of God is separate, which you are. Okay,
the word is corrupt. It's Pythyra, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it could mean to mongrelize, but what you are doing is you are limiting. First, you're limiting the definition of the word.
Right.
Right. Second, there's specific Greek words for race mixing.
Okay.
Right? And if that's what Paul meant, he would have used them.
Right.
You could corrupt a house in more than one way.
Right.
So he's really reading an idea into the Greek that's not in the word.
Yes.
I mean, is mongrelization one form of corruption?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Is mongrelization the only form of corruption? No.
Yes.
Does corruption mean mongrelization? Not necessarily.
Yeah, but mongrelization does mean corruption. Yes. Well, here's the King James translation. If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy. For the temple of God is holy, which temple are ye? Okay? And I think a lot of Judeo-Christians don't understand that this is not the third temple, the supposed third temple that the Jews are going to build just before the coming of the Antichrist, right? Some of them interpret this passage that way because Paul is clearly saying, our bodies are the temple. That's what he's obviously saying. So here,
absolutely. Yeah. But here Paul's meaning transcends just simple race mixing.
Right. No doubt. And so here is Arnold's comment in his email back to me. The word mongrelize is probably right, although I do not see the words defile and destroy translated elsewhere in the same way as the AST, right? So he agrees that the concept of mongrelization is certainly a form of corruption. But true, defile and destroy are the same word. The verbs are all present tense. Lexicon-wise, I would agree, though few would want to accept the meaning as mongrelize, right? So he's in sympathy with this translation.
Well, I would have to totally agree with what Kennedy just said.
Yeah, okay. And then he continues. I would also agree from Jude 1:10, but these speak evil of those things which they know not, but what they know naturally as brute beasts. In those things they corrupt themselves. Woe unto them, for they have gone in the way of Cain and ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward and perished in the gainsaying of Kor. So, you know, and these verses are absolutely about race mixing, no doubt about it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely true.
And then his final comment here, where the word is translated as corrupt and the sin was sex with foreigners and therefore mongrelization. The same goes for what Cain did. This explanation is worth tucking away in the mind for future use, Arnold. So I brought it out.
Well, right. But, yeah, you know, teaching little boys and girls to be homosexuals and lesbians, that's not mongrelization, but it's corruption.
That's right. That's right.
You know what I mean? So you're really adding a meaning, and you're limiting the meaning of
right.
the word corruption in 1 Corinthians 3 by translating as mongrelization.
Yes.
Because that's only one form of corruption.
Yes.
And
okay.
Paul's talking about corruption in general.
Yes. Okay. All right. So I just thought I'd bring that out because that was such a good letter. And, you know, in fact, I tried to get Harold to come on my show, but he would not come on live. He insisted that we record it and that he would have the editing privileges. I said, well, I mean, you know, come on, you know, we can go on live. What are you afraid of? Right? But I think he was aware that I'm an anti-preterist, even though Keith keeps calling me a preterist, right? So anyway, let's get into the book of Jeremiah, and I'm going to read from the survey from my King James Version here, and the introduction or survey slash preface.
Right,
this.
And I'll have about a page of notes on beginning Jeremiah. But
okay. Well, as I'm reading here, if your notes correspond to what I'm reading here, or you know, this guy is saying something that's just truly outrageous, you know, just feel free to break in here. Jeremiah's long ministry of over 40 years stretched from 625 B.C. until a few years after Judah ceased to be a state in 586 B.C., after 50 years of religious apostasy under Manasseh were eventually followed by religious reform under Josiah, 621 to 607 B.C., Jeremiah supported the reform with enthusiasm until he realized that it was not changing the people's hearts. 2 years after Josiah's death, the Battle of Carchemish established Babylonian control over Western Asia. From that time, Jeremiah advocated submission to Babylon, but without success. Under the last four kings of Judah, 21 years of religious apostasy and political weakness made the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. and exile inevitable. And as we found in the book of Ezekiel, Yahweh always punishes us when we refuse to obey his law and when we adopt the customs of pagans, the pagan nations around us. The distressing circumstances in which Jeremiah worked and the extraordinary extent to which idolatry had replaced revealed religion in Judah are clearly mirrored, and it's good, he says in Judah. He didn't say among the Jews, are clearly mirrored in Jeremiah's prophecies. So also is Jeremiah's spiritual anguish occasioned by this apostasy. Yet he was no pessimist. He was essentially God's warrior, but a warrior who was also watchman and witness. Chapter 1 describes Jeremiah's call to prophethood. Chapters 2 through 13 enable us to reconstruct the conditions in which he prophesied, while chapters 14 through 33 mirror his awareness of and his fellowship with God. The warrior then emerges as God's watchman and God's witness. In Jeremiah's oracles, God, the moral governor of the world, is Israel's covenant God. Through Israel, he sought to achieve moral purpose. This is really good so far. I mean, most of them are very bad, you know, with all kinds of universalism thrown in, and there's hardly any of that in this introduction. Through Israel, he sought to achieve moral purposes. Alas, the northern kingdom's adulteries with the Balaam compelled God to divorce, that is, exile her. Judah, the southern kingdom, failed to learn from Israel's experience. She outdid Israel in sexual impurities, yet Judah repudiated the charges of religious infidelity. Therefore, God must judge her. Repentance might have stayed divorce proceedings, her adulteries notwithstanding, so great is the Lord's grace. But so established was Judah in lewdness that she was incapable of moral amendment. Gradually, social virtues disappeared. Sacrifices and ritual failed as substitutes for repentance and righteousness. Judah's appalling sinfulness meant that sin must be congenital. I wonder if he'd say that about the Jews. Hence her moral inability. It sprang from a sinful nature. Judgment was inescapable and exile. But exile was not the final word. So far, this is pretty good.
Well, it's clear to Yahweh later in Jeremiah, it's clear that he also put away Judah.
Right.
And he has to by the law, and we'll discuss that when we get to it.
Yeah.
But we also have to bear in mind that most of Judah was taken away with Israel. The 46 fenced cities were over 200,000 captives in one inscription were taken away with Israel. And that's
cities, yes.
Well, right. And even though allegorically we see them depicted as two sisters in Israel and Judah, that's all prophetic allegory,
sure.
And most of Judah is with Israel.
Right. Yeah, and that's why James addresses his epistle to the 12 tribes, not the 10 tribes scattered abroad. Okay. One more paragraph here. A remnant would return to live under Messiah's rule in religious and social security. I don't know about the security. let's see. Messiah's righteous rule over righteous people helps explain Jeremiah's doctrine of the new covenant. People would be righteous because their hearts would be renewed. They would obey God's laws from the heart spontaneously. The new covenant, ensuring forgiveness and inward moral dynamic, would transcend the legalism of the old covenant, eventually through Christ's sacrificial death. And the inward regenerative activity of the Holy Spirit, the new covenant became a reality. Well, I don't know if it became. The law has not yet been written in our hearts. Too few Israelites operate that way. So that's for the future. And I think Isaiah 13, you know, the prophecy of the lamb will lie down with the lion. That hasn't happened yet.
But I think that the law is written in our hearts, except that the programming of the Jew erases it.
Right.
I mean, there are many times in history when we have established moral and decent nations.
Yeah.
And 1776 and the entire 19th century in this nation was one of them.
Yes, we had to be brainwashed and corrupted. Yes.
Well, when the Jews were allowed to come into the land in the late 19th century and set up all their little idols, they corrupted us from that righteous and pious nation that we were,
mm-hmm.
and God-fearing nation that we were.
Yes. Okay. Well, that concludes the introduction, and that was actually one of the better introductions of the books in this Bible. Okay. So go ahead. You said you had some.
Well, they dated Hosea a little late. I know there's different dates for most of the kings in prophecy. Jeremiah began his prophetic ministry in the 13th year of Hosea, which, according to some popular chronologies, he began his was 640 BC. So he began his ministry in 627 BC. Verse six in chapter one tells us that he began at a young age.
Okay.
And therefore his ministry was very long. I mean, it was like 35 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the later part of his ministry was contemporary with the younger Ezekiel. And Ezekiel began prophesying in 592 BC, right? In northern Mesopotamia, and Daniel began prophesying in Babylon shortly after 605 BC. So all three of these men are writing their prophecies at the same time.
Right.
Now, also the prophet Zephaniah recorded his prophecy in the days of Hosea. So he was also a contemporary with Jeremiah, and Zephaniah was also in Jerusalem. They may have even met, right? It's possible.
Okay.
The prophecy of Jeremiah is almost entirely centered on Judah, and it's very instrumental in realizing the nature of those Judahites and the Canaanites among them who have had such a prominent place in history since the 6th century B.C. I mean, it is this remnant of Judah that brought us both the apostles and the Christ and the Canaanite, Edomite, mixed Jews later on. And it was clear in Ezekiel, and it will be even much more clearer in Jeremiah, especially as early as the second chapter we're about to cover, And it's even quite explicit in Jeremiah that the sin and national decay of these people came as a result of race mixing and multiculturalism. And we must not forget that most of the tribe of Judah had already been taken away with the rest of Israel by the Assyrians under Sennacherib or Sennacherib.
Right.
That the Judah that Jeremiah addresses are almost exclusively those inhabitants and refugees in Jerusalem, which the Assyrians failed to conquer. And even though I'm sure there were also some other people scattered throughout the land that the Assyrians missed, right?
Sure.
Now, fragments of copies of Jeremiah were found among the Dead Sea Scrolls, both from the Hebrew and from the Greek.
Okay.
Parts of 31 out of Jeremiah's 52 chapters were well-preserved or mostly preserved in 6 scrolls of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay,
now,
in Hebrew
one
or Greek?
Thing, excuse me?
In Hebrew or Greek?
Oh, that's the Hebrew, right?
That's the Hebrew, okay.
Right, the Hebrew portions of Jeremiah. Major parts of 31 chapters were found in 6 different scrolls.
Okay.
Now, these 6 scrolls, the amazing thing is that these 6 scrolls are not the same. I'm going to make a quotation from the Dead Sea Scrolls Bible by Abeg, Flint, and Ulrich, where we find this quote. Two important scrolls, 2 out of the 6, right, reflect the Hebrew text that is very different than the Masoretic form of Jeremiah from which modern Bibles have been translated. It is also interesting to note that the biblical text in these 2 manuscripts is very similar to the Hebrew text from which the Septuagint was translated. And they noticed by doing a comparison, right?
Right.
This is true not only in small details, but also in major aspects where the Septuagint differs from the Masoretic text.
Okay.
Most notably, these 2 scrolls and the Septuagint present a version of Jeremiah that is about 13% shorter than the original version found in modern Bibles.
Yes.
Which are taken from the Masoretic, right? One example of this shorter text is in Jeremiah 10:3-11, which is a satire on idols. While the Masoretic text has all 9 verses, the Greek Bible and these 2 scrolls lack verses 6-8 and verse 10, which extol the greatness of God, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that they chose to illustrate one of the more innocuous differences to make the Masoretic text appear to be more pious, right?
Yeah.
Yet, it is clear that at a very early time, there were 2 copies of Jeremiah floating around. And we ended up, I think, with the worst of the 2 in our English Bibles.
Okay.
The major difference between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text, however, is the order of the scrolls.
Mm-hmm.
And after the verse found at Jeremiah 25:13, they're roughly the same up till then, right?
Yeah.
The order of the 2 different editions of Jeremiah is so different that they require a chart of at least 14 entries to track the differences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? At that chart, I have a couple of copies of it, and I'll probably end up typing it out and posting them on one of these programs, right? Probably when we get to Jeremiah 25 on my site, and that'll help people follow, because it's not the verses themselves that are jumbled, but the chapters and half chapters are sort of like jumbled up.
Okay.
And they're very different in the Septuagint in order. However, the Septuagint order makes a lot more sense.
Okay.
Okay. And we'll be discussing that as we proceed past Jeremiah chapter 4.
Well, what
the order?
Yeah.
and this is going to make textual comparisons a little more complex than usual, where they need to be noted throughout the presentation. And when we get to those chapters, I'll make notes of them.
Yes, yes. Okay. Well, everything you've said, you know, conforms to what I understand to be true of the Septuagint and the Masoretic texts. For, you know, just briefly for those people who haven't heard us talk about this before, that the Masoretic text is the Jewish redaction of the Hebrew Old Testament. And by redaction, I mean they threw away a lot of stuff. And what's left is what the Jews want us to know, right? And this is why the Septuagint, by and large, is larger, contains material that's missing from the Masoretic text, and which includes the missing 1,000 years of the patriarchs. And the reason why the Jews wanted to eliminate those 1,000 years is because they wanted to pretend that the Messiah would be born 1,000 years after when he was actually born, right? And that's why the Jews deliberately doctored the Hebrew, created a whole new kind of Hebrew called the square form Hebrew with vowel points so they could change vowels or in suggest vowels, okay? And that the Israelites of the New Testament followed the Septuagint by and large, and probably this Hebrew text that you're talking about, they probably had an original Hebrew text, but every time the Septuagint is compared with the Masoretic, we find that the New Testament authors, you know, Paul, Mark, John, Luke, etc., their source for the Old Testament was the Septuagint and or this other Hebrew text that's probably that your Dead Sea Scrolls scholars are talking about, okay?
Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, that they support the Septuagint. There are some bad translations in the Septuagint. There are some bad interpretations of names in the Septuagint.
Okay.
Like Phoenicians are not Canaanites, right?
Right.
And that's probably the worst one, but there are several others. But the Septuagint definitely came from a text of Hebrew far superior to the Masoretic text.
Right.
I can't throw the Masoretic text away because, first, we need to know the correct names.
Right.
And second, we really, because all translation is a matter of interpretation, it's really good to have the Masoretic text prophets alongside the Septuagint. They really both need to be studied. Josephus needs to be studied. Dead Sea Scrolls. We can't afford to discard any witnesses, right?
Right, right.
But we need all the witnesses we could get as to the scripture.
Yeah, and even though most scholars who have discussed this subject will agree that the Masoretic text has been corrupted, they generally won't put the blame on the Jews for that because they...
Oh, no, it's the Jews' fault, without a doubt.
Yeah, no doubt.
There's no doubt. But what we need the Masoretic text in order to understand the meanings of a lot of the Hebrew words that the Septuagint was translated from.
Right.
And in want of a better Hebrew text, and the Dead Sea Scrolls fills in some blanks, but a lot of stuff's still missing. And we need it. For instance, the word Anthropos is very similar to the English word man in its usage. It being very general, where the Hebrews had several specific words, and we need to know the differences.
Right.
And the Septuagint translators didn't always do a very good job of rendering 5 or 6 different Hebrew words meaning stranger into a couple of different Hebrew words, Greek words meaning stranger, alogenes and xenos, right?
Yes.
They basically made most of them xenos. And we have the same problems translating Hebrew into Greek than we have translating Hebrew into English, where we have these general terms, and the Hebrews had several very much more specific terms.
Yeah, ger would be a stranger of our race, and nokri would be a stranger of a foreign race.
Well, yes, and we just don't have that benefit in the Septuagint of realizing those differences.
Yeah, and the Masoretic doesn't make those distinctions either, and therefore the King James doesn't reflect the differences in terminology that they should.
Well, the Masoretic text itself has the distinctions, or we wouldn't know the Hebrew words at all. But when the King James translators translated them, they took the five or six different Hebrew words meaning stranger,
yes.
and you had Zur, Nakri, Nekar, Ger,
yes.
and they made them all stranger.
Right.
And they all have different different inferences in their meaning.
Yeah, and that's why the scriptures seem to contradict each other, because in some cases the strangers are good guys, and in other cases the strangers are bad guys.
Well, right, and the scriptures wouldn't contradict each other at all
right.
if we had the original Hebrew and we saw the differences between the
yes.
various words.
Yes, excellent. So it's very important for Christians to know the difference between the Septuagint and the Masoretic, and you know the basic fact is that since we do have the Masoretic text available to us and we can look at these actual Hebrew words, okay, and then if we do the word studies, we'll find out that they are different. Okay? It's just that the King James Version has failed to make note of the difference. But as you say, if we didn't have the Masoretic text, we couldn't determine that. We wouldn't know
that.
Now,
there's a few other things I'd like to say. Is it's very clear to me that Josephus had a much better Hebrew text than the Masoretic
okay.
text. And it's much more agreeable to the Septuagint in many places. But, you know, a lot of places were the Dead Sea Scrolls, where I would hope they filled the blanks in. Because some scriptures were definitely corrupted long before the Septuagint was translated.
Mm-hmm.
And we have Jeremiah 8:8 as a reference to that, right?
Yeah.
That the scribes had already turned the word of Yahweh into a lie. And they'd already been toying with the manuscripts.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Yeah, you know, the places where I hope the Dead Sea Scrolls would clear them up, they're almost all missing. Whenever
mm-hmm.
I turn to the Dead Sea Scrolls to hopefully referee or give me more insight into a verse that we dispute the meaning of, like Genesis 4:1, it just happens to be missing in the Dead Sea Scrolls, right?
Mm-hmm.
It always seems that there must be a dozen verses that I've checked hoping to see a better version in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In Genesis and in Jeremiah and some of the other prophets,
right.
and they're just missing.
Right. Yeah, the Dead Sea Scrolls material is very limited, but I'd say it's very, very important that we have that, because it does tend to verify the reality of the scriptures, if nothing else. You know,
well, absolutely,
yeah.
and it verifies a lot of the Septuagint readings, too.
Yes.
And makes us realize that the Septuagint is an important witness,
yeah.
just
oh.
as important as the Masoretic text.
Was there a Dead Sea Scrolls version of Daniel? Because the skeptics all want to say that Daniel couldn't possibly have been written when the Bible says it was, because no such accurate prophecies are possible, right?
Well, right, and Daniel is attested in Dead Sea Scrolls.
Right. Great.
In fact, I think the only Old Testament book not attested in the Dead Sea Scrolls is probably Esther.
Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, all right. Any more before we go into Jeremiah?
No, I'm ready for Jeremiah.
Okay, here we go. Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 1. The words of Jeremiah, the son of Hilkiah, of the priests that were in Anatoth in the land of Benjamin, to whom the word of Yahweh came in the days of Josiah, the son of Ammon, king of Judah, in the 13th year of his reign. It came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, to the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, to the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the 5th month.
Now, I got to say that this preface must be... It must be at least in part an interpolation, either by a scribe or by Jeremiah himself, doesn't matter,
uh-huh.
or perhaps by his famous original scribe, Baruch,
right?
That we're seeing that most of the prophets will say that the word of the Lord came to me at this time, and it's
right.
this year of this king.
Right.
But this also says it also came in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Jehoiakim. So that's a later prophecy, right?
Right.
And perhaps there are later chapters in Jeremiah.
Okay.
And then unto the end of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah. Well, that's the deportation.
Mm-hmm.
So this is giving us a summary of when Jeremiah received his prophecy,
right.
and not merely a beginning of when
right.
he received.
Yeah. So it sounds like an introductory listing of when the prophecies took place whereas compared to Daniel and Ezekiel, they just said, this day I got this prophecy, and then that prophecy, right? Those two books do not have a summary like this one.
Right. Here we have like a preface or something.
Yes. Okay. Preface. Yeah. Very good. Verse 4.
Now in verse 4, where the word came to me, the Septuagint has to him, as if it's continuing a preface written by somebody else. I just thought I'd make that note.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Verse 4, then the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. And before you came forth out of the womb, I sanctified you, and I ordained you a prophet to the nations. Okay, here's Yahweh giving us a statement of predestination for Jeremiah.
Right. And this is the same preordination or predestination that Paul often talks about.
Right.
And Paul's criticized for it.
Yeah.
I'd like to quote Galatians 1:15 and part of 16.
Okay.
But when it pleased Yahweh, who selected me from my mother's womb and called me through his favor to reveal his son by me, that I announce him among the nations.
Hmm.
And Paul catches hell for that statement very often from the Paul bashers. Yet Jeremiah makes the same sort of statement.
Right.
That Yahweh selected him. And these people believed in that preordination.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're doing something, I can't imagine, no matter what you're doing in life, whether it be sinning, doing good, doing bad, robbing banks, whatever you're doing in life, you even though we have free choice to do that, you can't believe that it wasn't within Yahweh's will and you're doing it somehow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whether his permissive will or his divine will, right? Because even if you're sinning, he has a permissive will. And you better believe that somehow he knew ahead of time, being God, that you were going to be a sinner, and he separated you for that. That's your purpose, is to learn something from that sin.
Right. It's all for our testing. You know, no matter what the circumstances are, it's all for our testing. And Paul says, well, we're not going to be tested beyond our ability to overcome the testing, right? So there's always free will involved. It always depends on what choices you make, right? So verse 6, then said I, ah, Yahweh Elohim, behold, I cannot speak, for I am a child. So how old was he here? What was your...
Well, you know, this child thing, I don't know why the King James translators translated it like that.
Okay.
I don't know what the Hebrew word is offhand, but the Septuagint word is neoteros, and that's the same word used of Paul at Acts 7:58.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
And he was a youth. He was a young man.
Yep.
He was probably under the age of 30, which is the age of maturity, from where a Levite could go out and do the deeds that a Levite did, and a man could start to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why if we see John the Baptist and the ministry of Christ, Christ started at 30.
Right.
That's actually written into the law, right?
That's right. It is.
So Jeremiah here is saying, whoa, I'm too young.
Right.
But that doesn't mean he was a child. He could have been in his early 20s and said this.
Right.
And I imagine that this denotes that he was possibly under 30 or just barely 30. But he was a young man.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, so it doesn't really fit. Youth would probably be best, you know, or 20-something.
Right. The Greek of the Septuagint definitely infers that he was a young man.
Uh-huh. Okay.
But I'm sure he was probably 20-something, if not barely 30.
Right. Okay, very good. Verse 7. But Yahweh said to me, say not, I am a child, for you shall go to all that I shall send you, and whatsoever I command you, you shall speak. Be not afraid of their faces, for I am with you to deliver you, says Yahweh.
Now, their faces is also their presence, right?
Okay. All right, yeah. Okay.
It's not that they had particularly ugly faces.
Right. Well, yeah, maybe scornful faces, what have you. Yeah.
Well, he's sending these people. He's sending Jeremiah to these people that are the rulers of the city.
Right. And they're very skeptical of his prophecies. They don't want to hear them.
And the young man wouldn't really want to do that.
That's
right.
Right.
Like, oh,
that's
you want
right.
me to go to them?
Yeah.
You want me to go there and say what?
You want me to go to Washington and tell those politicians they suck? Is that what you want me to do? They'll kill me, right?
Well, right.
Yeah. Verse 9, then Yahweh put forth his hand and touched my mouth, and Yahweh said to me, behold, I have put my words in your mouth. Okay, so as we have discussed previously, the original authors of the Bible, virtually every single one of them, declares that they were directly inspired by Yahweh to write these words.
Well, right, but I wouldn't accept a lot of the declarations of some of these freaks today, like that idiot that wrote that Talking with God book. And
oh, right, sure. No. Yeah, because if they're prophets, the prophecies have to come true, right?
Well, right. They have to come true every time, and it has to be short-term and long-term prophecies.
Yeah,
the short-term prophecies of the prophets that came true prove to us that the long-term ones will also come true.
That's right. Okay, verse 10. See, I have this day set over you, over the nations, and over the kingdoms, to root out and to pull down and to destroy and to throw down, to build and to plant. Okay?
Now this statement is defined in Jeremiah 18, 6 through 10.
Okay.
All right. O house of Israel, cannot I do with you as this potter, saith Yahweh.
Mm-hmm.
Behold, as the clay is in the potter's hand, so are you in my hand, O house of Israel. At what instant shall I speak concerning a nation and concerning a kingdom to pluck up and to pull down and to destroy it? If that nation against whom I have pronounced turn from their evil, I will repent of the evil that I thought to do unto them. At what instant shall I speak concerning a nation and concerning a kingdom to build and to plant it?
Mm-hmm.
So we see that this verse is defined later in the book of Jeremiah. That's how we have to understand it here.
Right.
And Bertrand Comper and Wesley Swift did right in imagining what Jeremiah planted,
mm-hmm.
because we're really not told that in the book of Jeremiah.
Okay.
That very well has to do with, and I'm sure we'll discuss that at length at the very end of his prophecy when we get
right,
to
right, exactly.
Chapter
yes. 15. Yeah, well, 2 Samuel 7:10, I believe it was, that talks about planting Israel in some other country, you know, and of course.
Oh, definitely, in a place that's not, can't possibly be interpreted as being anywhere in Palestine.
That's right. Okay, verse 11, moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me saying, Jeremiah, what see you? And I said, I see a rod of an almond tree. Now, the almond tree and the ash tree and the olive tree, those three trees have always been symbolic of the white race, okay? So
right, but there's a little more going on here with this almond tree.
Okay.
And I'd like to quote Fawcett's Bible Dictionary, where he explains 11 and 12 in this manner. I see a rod of the wakeful tree, the emblem of wakefulness.
Mm-hmm.
Thou hast well seen, for I will be wakeful as to my word, instead of hasten my word to perform it. And in other words, the almond tree also represented wakefulness, vigilance, alertness.
Okay.
But you know, the almond tree is also what Aaron's rod was made from.
Okay.
That was made from almond, and it sprouted almonds.
Right. Okay. All right, so verse 12, then said Yahweh to me, you have well seen, for I will hasten my word to perform it. Okay. In other words, these prophecies that Jeremiah is being given will shortly come to pass. Unlike much of the book of Daniel, where it says seal the book until the time of the end, right? We have a totally different approach to time in these two books. Verse 13.
Well, right, but Daniel was right, and Jerusalem was already done for the most part.
Right, yeah, and most of those prophecies, well, some of them were near term in terms of the fact that he prophesied that the Greeks would overthrow the Medes and Persians and vice versa, all that kind of stuff. Some of that stuff was new, but the prophecy clearly says it would not be understood until the end times, right? So. And it's true, most of these Bible interpreters have not had much clue, because the history that's depicted in Daniel was not that well known to the ancient world, and to our predecessors. Like, let's say 50 years ago, all of this history surrounding the book of Daniel. I mean, that had to take a lot of historians to assemble all that information, and it was not available to the general, you know, world until very recently, actually, you know.
Well, to me, the proof of Daniel is simply that it couldn't have been written in Hellenistic times because, and I've read a good number of Hellenistic writers, none of them knew anything about Babylon.
Uh-huh. Okay.
None of them knew anything about Babylon. And Daniel, you know, Daniel's descriptions and depictions of Babylon have been supported by the archaeological record.
Uh-huh.
And there's things that the Greeks of and the Judeans of the second and third centuries could not have known.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
They just simply couldn't have known it. And you know, if you read Herodotus, 450 B.C., he talks about Babylon and the magnificence of his walls, but he knows nothing about who built it.
Mm-hmm.
And the bricks in the wall said that Nebuchadnezzar built it.
Right.
but Herodotus makes a fanciful explanation that this queen built it.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, he doesn't know about Nebuchadnezzar.
Oh, Semiramis.
Yes, Semiramis.
Mm-hmm.
And he only lived 150 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, Nebuchadnezzar ascended to the Babylonian throne 605 B.C., and Herodotus is probably writing about 450 to 430 B.C.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he knows nothing about Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes.
And the archaeology proves that Nebuchadnezzar built those walls and those buildings,
mm-hmm,
like Daniel said.
Right.
But Herodotus didn't know a damn thing about it.
Yeah.
So how could anybody else know it? How did anybody else? None of the Hellenistic writers knew about Nebuchadnezzar.
Yes, yes.
But I've never seen his name, and they attribute the building of Babylon to Semiramis.
Right, right, yeah. But still, the critics want to suggest that Daniel was written post-prophecy, right?
Well, they just can't believe that Daniel prophesied that the four kings, the four kings, there would be three more kings in Persia, and a fourth will rise up, who was Xerxes, to make war against the Greeks.
In the 70
weeks?
You know,
Daniel, now, those four kings, Cyrus, Cambyses, Darius, Xerxes, Daniel nailed that to a T.
That's right.
And you know, you say that the book of Daniel is sealed. I agree with you, but that means that scroll. And Daniel encompassed multiple scrolls.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Okay.
That
sure.
Scroll is sealed. Yes, Daniel 12. But, however, I think that the Josephus used Daniel, and it's right in Antiquities, explains that they used the prophecies of Daniel to show Alexander the Great that they were expecting him.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And they brought him into the temple and had him sacrificed to Yahweh in the temple. That's a chapter in Josephus's Antiquities.
Right.
So they understood, it shows that they understood that part of Daniel.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that from the work that we've done with the chronology of Daniel's 70 weeks, that was what the apostles used. The people of Judea knew that 490 mm-hmm. prophetic years was just about up,
right.
And that's why they were expecting the Messiah at that time.
And then the book of Luke pretty much nails that interpretation, right, that they understood. They definitely understood that the time for the Messiah had come. And also I would say that the Druids, because the Druids, by and large, were actually paganized Levitical priests who understood the prophecies of Daniel. And when they heard that the Messiah had come in Palestine, they quickly converted to Christianity, right? That's what all the scholars say about the Druids, that they quickly turned to Christianity when they had heard the Messiah had come. So that proves, number one, that they're Israelites, and number two, that, you know, in fact, their prophet, the name of their prophet was spelled H-E-S-U-S. Jesus, right?
Well, there's no doubt that that Christianity was in Britain and Ireland and Gaul and at an early time, and it was very successful. And most of the Germanic, even though some of them had a hard time, most of the Germanic tribes and the Celtic tribes had no hard time at all converting to Christianity.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right.
Okay. And it was the Celtic Church thrived for a long time before the Roman Church even got started. And it was eventually sold out by the English, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, very good. Let's see, where were we? I think verse 12, here's the, verse 13. And the word of Yahweh came to me the second time, saying, what see you? And I said, I see a seething pot, a melting pot. All right. And the face thereof is toward the north. Then Yahweh said to me, out of the north an evil shall break forth upon all the inhabitants of the land.
And that would mean, of course, the Babylonians and their allies.
Mm-hmm. Okay. For lo, I will call all the families of the kingdoms of the north, says Yahweh, and they shall come, and they shall set everyone on his throne at the entering of the gates of Jerusalem, and against all the walls thereof round about, and against all the cities of Judah. And, of course, that's what the Babylonians did. They installed their own leaders. What do we call it today? It's just like our Zionist lords and masters install puppet kings in places like Afghanistan and Iraq, right? So the Babylonians were doing that then, and they're still doing it today. Verse 16, and I will utter my judgments against them, touching all their wickedness who have forsaken me and have burned incense to other gods and worshiped the works of their own hands, not giving Yahweh credit as creator. Verse 7.
Right, and let me say something about this statement against all the cities of Judah.
Uh-huh.
Well, while the Assyrians took 46 major cities and probably also many villages,
sure,
because the 46 cities they took are described as having been walled,
mm-hmm,
and that means it's not a village. That means it's a major town, right? A large town to be able to afford to build walls around it and to have to. Well, anyway, it's evident that after the Assyrian siege and the Assyrian threat had passed, later, the people of Jerusalem moved back out into many of the cities of Judah. And that's explained explicitly in 2 Chronicles chapter 32 from verse 26 forward,
mm-hmm,
that they had done that. That Yahweh states explicitly that Hezekiah had been provided with cities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And many of those cities were actually provided by Yahweh for the Levitical priests, so that those Levites would have been in those cities and taken captive by the Assyrians. Okay, so the Levites, although they were no longer a tribe, they were no longer counted as a tribe, they were still among the Israelites as a priesthood serving the rest of the tribes. Okay.
Well, right, but my point is that a lot of those cities were repopulated after the Assyrian threat passed.
Okay. Right.
And that's what 2 Chronicles chapter 32 highlights. So that's why here we see that there are more cities than just Jerusalem again.
Mm-hmm, right.
Right? Because this is 100-something years later, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Very good. Okay. So, let's see. Where was... Oh, yeah. Verse 17. You therefore gird up your loins and arise and speak to them all that I command you. Be not dismayed at their faces, lest I confound you before them. Okay? So, in other words, he's telling them not to be afraid. Tell these kings, judges, lawyers, emissaries, what have you, all these people in the court, you tell them what I want you to say. Verse 18, for behold, I have made you this day a defensed city.
Now, Jeremiah wasn't a city, I'm sorry.
Right, right.
He was a stronghold. Defense city should simply say stronghold. Right?
Okay.
That would be a positive reading.
Yeah, and an iron pillar. And, well, yeah, it's kind of, it would be kind of a strange metaphor. and an iron pillar and a brazen walls against the whole land, against the kings of Judah, against the princes thereof, against the priests thereof, and against the people of the land. And they shall fight against you, but they shall not prevail against you, for I am with you, says Yahweh, to deliver you. Sounds like the situation we're in here, Christian identity versus all of the deceived masses of Judeo-Christian Israel, right?
Well, we know the truth.
Yes.
The truth about the gospel. We have to spread it, and he'll protect us.
That's right.
And that's the way we have to look at it, or we're just useless servants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. And, of course, Ezekiel has that very famous line where if you fail to warn the people of Israel that, trouble's ahead, if you fail to give the warning, then they will perish and you shall perish too, right? And so we have to give the warning. We have to tell people what's what. That's our obligation as readers of the Gospels and as spreaders of the Word. Chapter 2, verse 1, moreover, the word of Yahweh came to me, saying, go and cry in the ears of Jerusalem, saying, thus says Yahweh, I remember you, the kindness of your youth, the love of your espousals, when you went after me in the wilderness, in the land that was not sown. Okay, let's see, what era would we be talking about here? In the wilderness, would he be talking about the 40 years wilderness, the land that was not sown before they entered Canaan land? That's what it sounds like here, hearkening back to that era.
Well, it may well be. It's using the whole history as an allegory, right?
Yeah, okay. All right, verse 3, Israel was holiness to Yahweh, and the first fruits of his increase, all that devour him shall offend, evil shall come upon them, says Yahweh.
Well, this is all that devoured Israel shall offend.
Yeah.
And like today, and like we saw in Jeremiah 38 and 39, all of the other races shall eventually be punished.
Mm-hmm.
They're devouring us now. They will be punished. Yahweh is using them as a scourge against us, and most of our people well deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
But they will be punished for doing it, just like the Assyrians were punished after Yahweh used them as a scourge. And
yes,
the Babylonians were punished after Yahweh used them as a scourge.
Right. And the priests who are promoting all this race mixing and false doctrine, they will be doubly punished. Right?
Well, absolutely.
Yes. Okay, verse 4. Hear you the word of Yahweh, O house of Jacob, and all families of the house of Israel. Thus says, now he's addressing Judah here, okay? But even those Judahites who came back under Ezra and Nehemiah, they referred to themselves as Israel.
Right.
They never lost their awareness that they were Israelites.
Absolutely not. And that makes the Ephraim skeptic crowd just a bunch of fools that don't read the whole Bible.
Right, right. Verse 5, thus says Yahweh, what iniquity have your fathers found in me, that they are gone far from me and have walked after vanity and are become vain? Well, it's our rebellion against his law, right? Number 6, neither said they, where is Yahweh that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, that led us through the wilderness, through the land of deserts and of pits, through the land of drought and of the shadow of death, through a land that no man passed through and where no man dwelled? You know, where is our thankfulness? Where is our recollection of what Yahweh has done for our people?
And that's definitely talking about the 40 years,
right,
in the desert.
That's for sure, yes. Verse 7, and I brought you into a plentiful country to eat the fruit thereof and the goodness thereof. But when you entered, you defiled my land and made my heritage an abomination. Well, one of the things they certainly did, he instructed them to exterminate all those Canaanites. And instead, many of the tribes took them as slaves instead of exterminating them. So that's what he calls an abomination, detestable.
Well, that desire for cheap labor has probably always been our primary downfall. It gets us every time.
You mean the Mexicans are desire? Yes.
Pick your own cotton.
That's right. That's right. The priest said not, where is Yahweh? And they that handle the law knew me not. The pastors also transgressed against me, and the prophets prophesied by Baal, and walked after things that do not profit. And, of course, Josiah, he was inspired by the fact that one of his priests actually found the books of the law buried in the basement somewhere, right?
Well, right, and that sparked his reformation.
That's right.
But they mourned because they found the books of the law. Like, oh, no, we're supposed to be living by these.
Yeah, which shows how few of the other kings and priests regarded the law with any, piety, you know, or had no value for it, because they just buried it.
I don't want to compare the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence to the laws of God.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more important, right?
Sure.
But look at this country. Look at what we've done with our founding documents. The law of God was the founding document of the ancient kingdom of Israel.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And after a couple of hundred years, not even a couple of hundred years, after the time of the judges, we had kings for 80 years, Saul and David, and Solomon transgressed the law, and the books went into the pit, and they forgot about them. and Rehoboam, and I'm sorry, Jeroboam has his people in the northern tribes worshiping golden calves. This is Solomon's time.
Right.
And that's it. I mean, it didn't take long at all. Not even 100 years under kings.
Right.
It took, and they buried the law, and that they don't dig it out again until the time of Joash.
Yes.
That's 300 years later. That's crazy.
Yeah.
And today, yeah, you know, we have a constitution and a Declaration of Independence and all these founding documents. And I'd say it was probably about 110, 120 years to 1913, right?
Mm-hmm.
From 1790. And where are they? They're in a trash heap somewhere.
That's right.
We give them lip service and pay no attention, our political leaders, and pay no attention to them whatsoever.
Right.
I'm just making an allegory. It's the same pattern.
Right.
We have these founding documents, we have these covenants that we found a nation with, and 100 years later, we still have a semblance of the nation,
yes.
But we forget our founding documents.
Well, it's the same. It's exactly the same principle. The Old Testament says over and over, if you bring people of a foreign race into your country, you will adopt their customs.
And that's exactly what we do.
That's right.
Today we act like those Sicilian Jews and Hungarians, Eastern European Jews that we let into here.
That's right.
We act just like them.
Mm-hmm.
We act like the Negroes that we gave equal citizenship.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, it's so obvious that that statement is true, and Yahweh makes it at least a dozen times, if not more, that he says, do not bring those people into your countries, otherwise you will start behaving like them, right? And
Sure. Israel permitted the Canaanites and forgot about the law, and 100 years later they were acting like Canaanites.
That's right.
Same thing.
That's right. Very good. Okay. The priests said that, and they prophesied by Baal, so their worship changed from, you know, honoring Yahweh to honoring Baal, and walk after things that do not profit. Wherefore, I will yet plead with you, says Yahweh, and with your children's children will I plead. He's not going to give
them
up.
It's a racial covenant.
That's right.
He's having he knows he's having these people taken away. That's why he commissioned Jeremiah, to tell them that they were going to be taken away, to tell them the city was going to be destroyed.
Right.
But he's still going to plead with their children's children, even though they're taken away.
And that includes
us. There's never any loss of the scope of the fact that it's a racial covenant.
Right, right. For pass over the isles of Chittim and see, and send to Kedar, and consider diligently, and see if there be such a thing. Has a nation changed their gods, which are yet no gods, but my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be astonished, O you heavens, at this, and be horribly afraid. Be you very desolate, says Yahweh. And, of course, we are made desolate when we bring non-whites into our countries. Absolutely. Verse 13, for my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed them out cisterns, broken cisterns, that can hold no water. And I know you want to say a lot about this one.
Well, right. This is the
Famous broken cisterns verse, yes.
Yeah, this is what I base my broken cistern papers on.
Mm-hmm.
That this is the fountain of living waters. Christ said that you know, come to me and drink from the fountain of living waters.
Mm-hmm.
When he spoke to the woman at the well in John chapter 4.
Mm-hmm.
He is the fountain of living waters.
Yeah.
A broken cistern is a vessel that can hold no water because it's broken. The water leaks out of it.
Mm-hmm.
The body is the vessel for the Spirit of God.
Mm-hmm.
Once you mix your race, the DNA code is broken, and so is the cistern.
Yes.
You can't have a mamzer, a mongrel, a half-breed, hold the spirit which Yahweh imparted to Adam. It's not possible.
Mm-hmm.
That person is a broken cistern.
Right.
These people had children with men and women of other races, which in this case is the Hittites and the Canaanites.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the allegory, that those children cannot any longer hold that spirit. I'd like to quote Proverbs 5:15-23,
mm-hmm.
and I also quote this in the broken cisterns paper. Drink waters out of thine own cistern. This is a warning to keep your race pure.
That's right.
And running waters out of thine own well.
Mm-hmm.
Let thy fountains be dispersed abroad, meaning widely. And if you do that, if you stay with your own race, your fountains will be dispersed widely.
Yes.
And rivers of waters in the streets. Now, here it is. Let them be only thine own and not the strangers with thee.
Mm-hmm.
And don't have strangers with you or aliens.
Right.
Let thy fountain be blessed and rejoice with the wife of thy youth. Don't go chasing little Chinese girls in middle age.
Right.
Let her be as the loving hind in the pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy thee at all times, and be thou ravished always with her love. And why wilt thou, my son, be ravaged with a strange woman
mm-hmm.
and embrace the bosom of a stranger?
Right. No, the word stranger would obviously be from a word like nokri and not ger, because ger would be a stranger of one's own race. So I don't know, did you look up those words and see the...
Well, no, I could
mm-hmm.
probably...
But you don't have to do it now. I was wondering if you did that in your broken cisterns papers. Did you...
Well, no, but it's nokri.
Okay,
I don't remember if I covered that in my papers,
mm-hmm.
but the word is nokri. It's a foreigner. It's
right.
alien.
Okay,
it's not a ger, who is most likely a racial kindred, but a national
right,
bond.
Right. Now, it's interesting that word, whether you pronounce it nokri or nokri, it's related to the word nekar, which in the Eastern languages means not quite, right? Not exactly. So you know, it has a sense of not being quite right, like something polluted, right? Okay.
Well, there's one gentleman that corresponds with me. I host a blog for him at vandal.christiania.org. He brought it to my attention. I mean, it's probably been brought to my attention before, but he believes that Nekar is the root for the Latin word niger.
Okay.
Or nigger, right? And that is very plausible
mm-hmm.
because I have a whole list of Latin words that came from Hebrew. So
right.
So this adding this one isn't beyond comprehension, right?
Right, right, yeah. And so a negro, or as LBJ pronounced it, negro, right?
Right. Well, you know, my people have committed two evils. They have forsaken me.
Mm-hmm.
We leave our God. Judah married the daughter of a strange God.
Yeah.
Malachi 2:11. And that means that he married a racial alien, and that's from where the Shelahites come, right?
Right.
One third of the tribe of Judah. And they were never any good from the beginning. and probably the source of many of our problems throughout our history.
Well, yeah,
however,
that
is what a broken cistern is. It's definitely somebody of a mixed marriage, of a different race or of a Mamzer, yeah, you know, a Mongol.
Well, the book of Exodus tells us that you know, there was a mixed multitude that came out of Egypt with the Israelites, and it was this mixed multitude that began all the whoring.
And they were just done away with in the desert. That's
mm-hmm.
why they had to spend 40 years in the desert.
Right.
But you know what that Hebrew word is? Arab.
Okay. right.
If you look up that Hebrew word for the mixed multitude that followed the children of Israel out of Egypt
uh-huh.
in the Exodus, the word is Arab.
Yeah, it's spelled E-R-E-B, you know, but it's, yeah, it's
well,
same
right,
as
it's
A-R-A-B.
Arab.
Right.
It's still Arab.
That's
I mean,
right.
We can play games with the vowels all day. But.
Right, yeah. Okay, very good. Verse 14, is Israel a servant? Is he a homeborn slave? Why is he spoiled or plundered? The young lions roared upon him and yelled, and they made his land waste. His cities are burned without inhabitants. Also, the children of Naph and Tapanhes have broken the crown of your head. Okay, this sounds like, because we're in the later chapters, Jeremiah warned the house of Judah, the leaders of Judah, not to make a league with the Egyptians because Yahweh didn't want them to do that, but they did it anyway, and so therefore they would be punished for that as well.
Okay. Right, and I haven't I haven't studied it wholly, but I discovered just a couple of weeks ago doing one of our other programs, maybe it was Ezekiel or something else that came up recently, and Tapanhes actually had, and archaeological data indicates this, a very large Greek presence at this time.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay, interesting.
And that's very interesting. And especially in the context of Jeremiah's and a lot of the Hebrews ending up there.
Yeah.
You know, fleeing to there from the presence of the Babylonians, right?
Right.
And now Naaf is better known to us as Memphis.
Okay.
And that's what the Septuagint calls it.
Uh-huh. And Memphis was the center of, was that the center of the religion, or was that where the pharaohs stayed at this time? Any idea?
No, I think the pharaohs were still at Thebes.
Okay.
I'm not really sure. Memphis was a major and notable city, but I'm not really positive why at the moment. I'd have to look it up.
Okay. All right. Verse 17. Have you not procured this to yourself in that you have forsaken Yahweh your Elohim when he led you by the way? And now what have you to do in the ways of Egypt to drink the waters of Sihor, or that you have to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river? So it looks like... Obviously, the name Hebrew, well, according to some philologists anyway, say it means colonizer. And our people have always been colonizers. The problem with our colonies is race mixing goes on in our colonies, right? And so it sounds like that's what's being addressed here. Verse 19, your own wickedness shall correct you, and your backsliding shall reprove you. And Ezekiel said this at least a dozen times. Know, therefore, and see that it is an evil thing and bitter that you have forsaken Yahweh your God, and that my fear is not in you, says Yahweh Elohim of hosts. Verse 20. For of old time I have broken your yoke and burst your bands, and you said, I will not transgress. And that's, of course, the first time our people said that was in Exodus 19:8, where they took the oath that we will do everything that Moses says, right? When upon every high hill and under every green tree you wander, playing the harlot.
Now that's we only have freedom from bondage by following the ways of our God, right?
That's right.
As soon as we depart from the ways of Yahweh, we will inevitably become slaves to the princes of this world.
That's right.
There's no doubt.
Right.
Now that waters of Sihor is a reference to the Nile, most likely.
Oh, okay.
And that's the NAS writes Nile there.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Now, and then here the last phrase in verse 20, playing the harlot. Since we are talking about a nation, it can't be talking about unmarried sex between individuals.
Okay. Well, no, it's talking about the marital relationship between Israel and the nation as the wife of Yahweh,
mm-hmm.
and God himself. And that's when we wander from his ways and follow the ways of the other nations individually, that often means we're committing fornication.
That's right.
Especially at this time. And in those broken cistern pamphlets, I more or less demonstrate that fornication religiously meant fornication personally,
mm-hmm.
because those Baal religions were all religions based on sexual fertility rituals.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And communing with other races in any sort of social setting anyway is the natural precursor to race mixing.
Mm-hmm.
There's no doubt.
That's right. That's right.
And Yahweh told his people that they would be a separate people.
Right.
When we're not separate, we race mix.
And that's what the sin of Balaam was all about, very clearly.
Absolutely.
So,
it was all about sex.
There's no doubt about it. The prophecy, the accounts are very clear that's what the sin of Balaam was all about, that the Israelite men were seduced by the Midianite women. And, you know, so having sex with non-Israelites and converting to their religion, those things go hand in hand.
Well, right. So it's not the churches would like to say, oh, it's spiritual harlotry.
Yeah.
Well, no, it's not.
Uh-huh.
It's partaking in sexual fertility rituals.
That's right.
And the race mixing which comes along with worshiping gods of other cultures.
That's right. That's right. If
you go to study in India as a young man,
yeah.
and you go off to India to study Hinduism, 9 times out of 10, you're going to come back with a brown wife.
That's right. That's right. Or Islam. Right? Verse 20, yeah. Verse 21, Yet I had planted you a noble vine, and by the way, that word Aryan means noble. I could translate, yet I had planted you an Aryan vine, a holy right seed. How then are you turned into the degenerate plant of a strange vine to me, right? There's a word degenerate. I suppose there's such things as a spiritual degenerate. However, a spiritual degenerate probably engages in physical degeneracy as well, right?
Well, this is race mixing, period.
Yeah.
The NAS translation is really good here.
Okay.
But they probably think it's talking about Jews, right? So it's really good here. Where it says, yet I planted you a choice vine, a completely faithful seed.
Mm.
How then have you turned yourself before me into the degenerate shoots of a foreign vine?
Mm-hmm.
And that can only be done through race mixing.
Right. Right. Somebody's hybridizing.
Well, right. And the next verse will reinforce that.
Right. Verse 22. For though you wash you with nitre, and that we still have, I forget the name of it, nitrogen soap, I guess you could call it. And, it used to be very common when I was growing up anyway. Fels, naphtha, okay, that kind of soap. I don't know if they make it out of naphtha anymore. Anyway, for though you wash you with nitre, and take you much soap, yet your iniquity is marked before. Yeah, you can't wash the mulatto skin off your body, right? Verse 23.
Well, nitre here is carbonate of soda. And according to the enhanced Strong's, right?
Oh, okay. All right.
It's called nitre,
lye.
Soda, carbonate of soda. Lye, right.
Yes.
And yes, that's what this means. I mean, a bastard can't wash his half of his genetics away from his skin.
Right. Verse 23, how can you say I am not polluted? Right. Spiritually polluted, right?
And the Edomite Jews exclaimed to Christ that we are not children of fornication, when they indeed were.
Yeah.
And a bastard can't even know of what an illegitimate marriage is.
Right.
Oh, my parents got married in church. Well, yeah, right. Okay. Well, you're still half black.
Right. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Right. How can you say I am not polluted? I have not gone after Balaam. See your way in the valley. Know what you have done. You are a swift dromedary traversing her ways. Okay. So, in other words, I think what he means here is you're running from one illicit affair to another. Verse 24. A wild ass used to the wilderness that snuffs up the wind at her pleasure in her occasion, who can turn away? All they that seek her will not weary themselves. In her months they shall find her. Okay, so it's talking about persistent fornication with non-Israelites. He's accusing the whole nation. Of course, obviously not every Judahite or Benjamite was engaging in this sort of thing.
Well, let's say we're all mixed. Jeremiah would have only seen one basket of figs, right?
Right, right.
He saw two baskets of figs, good and bad.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Verse 25, withhold your foot from being unshod and your throat from thirst, but you said, there is no hope. No, for I have loved strangers, and after them will I go. And our people are doing it again.
And this proves the entire interpretation of the verses which precede as they were given here, and as we discussed, that they have everything to do with race mixing.
Yes.
The Septuagint has the last part of this verse, but she said, I will strengthen myself, for she loved strangers and went after them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Verse 26, as the thief is ashamed when he is found, so is the house of Israel ashamed. They, their kings, their princes, and their priests, and their prophets. And, of course, when the prophet Ezra came back from Babylon, he was shocked at the amount of race mixing that was going on, from among the returnees. And he told them, well, you have to give up your foreign wives or you will be kicked out. Both Ezra and Nehemiah said that in no uncertain terms. Verse 27, say to a stock, you are my father, and to a stone you have brought me forth.
That's evolution. That's the evolutionist.
Right. Yeah.
That's exactly what they do.
For they have turned their back to me and not their face, but in the time of their trouble they will say, arise and save us. Now, of course, none of these criticisms will be applicable to the Jews because they are of mixed race. What could all this fornication be about? You know, we have to spiritualize all this language, and even though, you know, we're constantly talking about strangers, and most of the time that word is translated from the Nokri, okay?
Well, if it was spiritual, why would you try to wash it off with niter?
Right. Spiritual
niter. Well,
why
would you try to wash it off with soap?
Spiritual soap. Wash your mouth out with spiritual soap, right? Verse 28. But where are your gods that have made you? Let them arise if they can save you in the time of your trouble. For according to the number of your cities are your gods, O Judah. So it looks like every city had a different god. Verse 29, why will you plead with me? You all have transgressed against me, says Yahweh. In vain have I smitten your children. They received no correction. Your own sword has devoured your prophets like a destroying lion. Oh, you know, and this is probably why Jeremiah was afraid to say these things, right? Verse 31, O generation, see you the word of Yahweh. Have I been a wilderness to Israel? A land of darkness. Why say my people, we are lords, we will come no more to you? Let me point out really quickly here. You know, of course, Yahshua said to the Jews of his day, the scribes and Pharisees, oh, you generation of vipers, which obviously means they're of a different race or a different ethnic group.
Well, right, they're a race of serpents.
That's right, serpents, going back into Genesis 3:15. And certainly, if Yahweh had called his own people a race of vipers, I would have been surprised here, but he doesn't. Verse 32, can a maid forget her ornaments or a bride her attire? Yet my people have forgotten me, days without number.
And this invokes, again, the marriage relationship between Yahweh and Israel.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Why trim you your way to seek love? Therefore, have you also taught the wicked ones your ways? Well, they learned it from the wicked ones, and I guess they're just going around teaching each other. Verse 34, also in your skirts is found the blood of the souls of the poor innocents. I have not found it by secret search, but upon all these. They're doing it out in the open, just as they are today.
Well, even if it's the Jews in our nation doing it, or the Negroes in our nation doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They're killing most of the white people that die in this nation.
That's right.
Even if it's them doing it, in our sin, we are still responsible for the blood of our brethren.
Right.
It's our nation, and we let them get away with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we vote for it. We go to the polls and vote for it all the time.
Right. Well, how did Obama get elected? It was all those guilty white folk who wanted to prove that they weren't racist, right?
Well, right, but I mean, we went to the polls and voted for the Civil War. We went to the polls and voted for Woodrow Wilson, got elected during World War One. It's the build-up to World War One. FDR, how many times did he get elected during World War Two?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, you know, these politicians start these wars, or they start these policies that are detrimental to our race, whether it be abortion or anything else. They support these policies. We vote for them, so therefore we as a nation are responsible for the our brethren who are getting killed because of these policies.
Yes, yes. Verse 35, but yet you say, because I am innocent, surely his anger shall turn from me. Behold, I will plead with you because you say I have not sinned. Of course, they have sinned. Verse 36, why gad you about so much to change your way? You also shall be ashamed of Egypt, as you were ashamed of Assyria. Yea, you shall go forth from him, and your hands upon your head, for Yahweh has rejected your confidences, and you shall not prosper in them. Okay, so it's very clear that Yahweh is angry with his people Israel. Fortunately, not everybody was doing, and I think Ezra and Nehemiah are instructive here, because it's very clear from what they say that it was primarily the leaders of the country who were engaging in race mixing in those days. And we wouldn't expect the farmers and the peasants and the people in the smaller villages to be engaging in this sort of thing, because they don't have the strangers coming into their neighborhoods. You know,
I see the same pattern. The same pattern all through history.
Yes,
it always starts in the cities. It always starts with the urbane people. It always starts with the wealthy. It always starts with the politicians and the leaders.
Right. Exactly.
They're always setting an example. Bad one.
Bad example. Yes. And of course, the cities are where the Jews live. So that's where the corruption always starts. And so it's very clear. Anybody who thinks that the Jews are a pastoral people and a farming people, forget it. That ain't happening. The Jews have always flourished in the cities. And of course,
the only time a Jew moves to a small town is when he buys the feedlot, right?
Right, right. Yeah, or he buys the farm and he makes the Gentile so-called work on it. That's the only time, In fact, that's true in the Israeli state, because on their kibbutzes, the Jews don't do any farming. They hire Arabs to do the farming, right? And they just put out the propaganda line that, good Jews come from New York City and work the farms at the kibbutzes. No, they don't. They hire Arabs. That's what's really going on over there. Okay, that's just more propaganda. Okay, Bill, I think we can, since we only have about 5 minutes to go, let's quit here, and we'll continue next Friday night with Chapter 3, okay? And tomorrow we're going to start on the Epistles of John, and then from there we will go to the Book of Revelation. Can't wait. Okay?
Wonderful.
All right. Thanks for joining me again. Thank you all for listening tonight, and we'll all meet at the kibbutz, right? Praise Yahweh. Yahweh bless all of Christian Israel. Good night.
Praise
Thank you. Praise God.